This is a recording from the New Dominion Bookshop brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit us on the web at cvillepodcast.com. On Tuesday, February 26, 2008, author Susan Gregg Gilmore presented her debut novel, Looking for Salvation at the Dairy Queen. Gilmore spoke for several minutes about the course of her writing career and especially about the support and encouragement she received from author Lee Smith.
It was a dream, really, for me to be surrounded on this jacket cover by Lee and Jill, two of my all-time favorite Southern female writers. And I was just telling my new friends here that I had practically just accosted Jill at a conference and begged her to please contribute. And so that was a real thrill for me. To be quite honest, I never thought of myself as a Southern writer or a novelist. I was always a journalist. And from the time I was in the third grade, when my mother read a little paper I'd brought home from school and said, you know, you really should be a writer. And I remember thinking, yeah, okay, that sounds good to me. And I'd always identified myself as a writer. But as I got older and actually came to UVA and wrote for the Cavalier Daily, it became very clear that I wanted to be a journalist. And I went off and had some internships at some newspapers. And then when I graduated, I ended up at the Smithsonian and thought, no, what I really want to do is curatorial work. I want to write the exhibition text and the coffee table books. Still wanted to write, but in a completely different format. And then, you know, life just kind of takes you in all sorts of directions and ended up back at a newspaper at the Chattanooga Free Press when my youngest daughter was born. And it was a wonderful opportunity to work a few hours a week, and we were an afternoon paper, so I'd get there at 6 and then was, you know, home by noon. And shortly after I got there, they asked me to do a column about parenting in the South. And that really gave me my first opportunity to do any type of creative writing at all. And I loved it. And no sooner had I started, my husband came home and said, what do you think about moving to California? And I thought, oh, great. but I went. And not long after I was there, met a friend, and one thing, you know, leads to another. And before I knew it, I was freelancing for the LA Times, a little bit for Parenting Magazine, which I was telling you that was a nightmarish experience. I spent 2 months writing a 2-inch piece on a baby picking up a Cheerio with their thumb and forefinger. So I found that magazine writing was not really for me because I think they have way too much time to think about things. So I kept writing for the LA Times and then started working a little bit for the Christian Science Monitor. And after I spent 4 months working on a piece for the Monitor about ex-convicts re-entering the workforce and was paid just a tiny bit of money, just, you know, a few hundred dollars, I thought, you know what, I've got to find something else. I've got 3 kids going to college. And I was just thinking very pragmatically. I mean, it's just, I've got to make more money to contribute to the family. And I live in L.A., so I'm going to write a screenplay, because that's what everybody else is doing. So I went over to Samuel French, the very hip, edgy, entertainment, industry-driven bookstore on the west side of town, and mother of 3 looked very, very out of place, and bought a How to Write a Screenplay book, went home, read a chapter, and realized, I have no idea how to write a screenplay, nor do I have any desire to write a screenplay. It's, you know, obviously very dialogue driven, and that was not something that I was drawn to. So I thought, well, somebody said write a treatment, you know, 10, 12 pages, the idea for a screenplay, and I thought, okay, I can do that. And as soon as I did and gave it to friends in the industry, they all said, you really need to write a novel, that's your voice. And I looked at them and thought, well, easy for you to say. You know, this is a lot of work, and there's no guarantee that anything is going to happen. And at that time, I thought, I need to have a guarantee. And about 20 pages into it, it just didn't matter anymore. I absolutely loved the process, and I loved these people, and I couldn't imagine doing anything but this. And I was very fortunate, as I was telling everyone here, that Lee Smith was my seventh grade English teacher, and so we'd stayed in touch, and I sent her the first 80 pages. Well, actually, that's not true. I actually went to that conference on Southern literature in Chattanooga and ran into her, grabbed her would probably be more accurate, and told her that I had been writing. And she just looked at me with those beautiful eyes and said, well, then we need to spend some time together, don't we? And we had coffee, and I gave her those pages, and she said she'd be in touch. Well, I didn't hear, and I didn't hear, and I thought, ugh, she hates it. She just doesn't know how to tell me. And finally, she sent an email telling me that she loved it and that I needed to keep going. And that's what I did. And by the time I was done, I mean, I can't lie and say that I didn't want to see it published. But at the end of the day, it really didn't matter. I just, if I had to take it to Kinko's and give it to my mother as a Christmas present, I would have felt complete. But I was very fortunate that was not, although it will be my mother's Christmas present, did not turn out that way. And I, have found this wonderful agent in New York just through a mass mailing, mass submission. Lee had written me a letter, and that definitely pulled me out of the slush pile. She says it has nothing to do with it, but I think we all would agree that's not true. And then I've been very fortunate to be with Crown, and my editor, actually Shay Earhart, is a Southern girl herself from South Carolina, so we've had a very wonderful rapport and really understand where each other is coming from. And I'm not a small town girl like Catherine Grace. Well, I am and I'm not. People ask me if it's autobiographical. It's not. Although, Catherine Grace, for those of you, you may not have read it yet. So let me to Catherine Grace, the main character, is this girl from a small town in North Georgia who great grandfather was the Baptist preacher, grandfather and father. And all this girl wants is to get out of town. So on her 18th birthday, she has committed that she's going to pack her bags and leave. And that's exactly what she does. And she heads to the Emerald City, which for her is Atlanta, and seems to have some success there. And things are really going well for her when she gets some tragic news that takes her back home. And then when she gets home, she finds out a lot of things about her family that she had never known and really had to come to peace in the very place that she started from. I think it's incredibly coincidental or divine that the day that we moved into our house in Nashville, the town that I was born and raised in, the town that I had not lived in 30 years, on the very same street that I grew up on, I was unpacking a box of books and I got a call from my agent that we had sold the book. So I thought, like Catherine Grace, I really came full circle to find salvation. And but I did, even though I grew up in Nashville, I had a grandfather who was a moonshiner, gambler, boxer, and went to a revival, found the Lord, and then, the next day he was a preacher. And he lived in Chattanooga and pastored a church for many, many years. And then when they retired to a little lake house that my parents owned out in Mount Juliet, Tennessee. I don't know if any of y'all have been to Mount Juliet, but it actually was smaller than Ringgold. There were about two gas stations that sold bait and tackle and a little Baptist church that needed a preacher and a Dairy Queen. And my grandfather had not been there long when he decided he needed to pastor this church. So even though we grew up in Nashville, we spent many of our weekends and almost all of our summer out on Old Hickory Lake with Nana and Pop and went to church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday, and after. Every time we went to church, then Pop would take us down to the Dairy Queen to get a dilly bar. So it was, I told someone once, it wasn't like just traveling 20 miles outside of Nashville. It was traveling like 50 years back in time, just to a very, very different place than I knew in the city. And I mean, for instance, I was 12 and my grandmother let me drive her Buick LeSabre all over the county. I mean, I drove her to get her hair done. I drove her to the market. She didn't want to drive. And she knew if somebody pulled us over, well, the sheriff pulled it, he wouldn't do anything because she was the preacher's wife. So it was a very unique upbringing, and I'm so grateful for it now. I mean, he had the big baptisms in the lake, just like in the book, and it was really just a festival of color and sights and sounds, and I think even though it's not autobiographical, there are definitely parts of this book that are a part of my own life journey. And all of the characters most of them are inspired by family members, some friends, mostly family members. Gloria Jean, who's very, very colorful, is actually based on my own aunt, Gloria Jean, and next time I will do a little bit better to disguise names, because apparently she wants to have a little come to Jesus meeting with me about what is true and what is not true. Like the Gloria Jean in the book, though, she was married 5 times. Gloria Jean in the book is married 5 times. Although my aunt has now been ordained in the male and is performing wedding ceremonies out in Wisconsin. So that'll be another book down the road, I think.
Next, Gilmore read a passage from Looking for Salvation at the Dairy Queen.
So anyway, I think what I'm going to do is read the part to you from the beginning where Catherine Grace is kind of explaining, you know, why she is the way she is and why she's stuck in this town. Truth be told, I think Daddy was a little bit scared of the world beyond the Catoosa County line. And I guess I can't blame him. Every night he would get comfortable in his reclining chair, turn on the television, and then let Walter Cronkite convince him that the world was much too dangerous for anyone he loved. Boys were getting themselves blown up every day in some country I knew nothing about. Grown women were pulling off their bras and burning them in broad daylight for everyone to see. And a man named Martin Luther King was telling the black people they deserved a better life. And everybody around town seemed afraid that they might actually get it. Daddy said the devil was sneaky, that he's been known to take the shape of ordinary-looking people. That's why, Daddy said, you always had to look someone in the eyes, because that's where you could see the greed and the hate and all the impure thoughts. But from where I was sitting on the brown braided rug on our living room floor, all I could see in my daddy's eyes was fear. I think he thought that here in Ringgold he could keep his baby safe, just like his daddy had done and his daddy's daddy. You see, 3 generations of Klein men have been known for 3 things, their love of the Lord, their devotion to their family, and their commitment to growing the perfect tomato. And even though this was not my life's ambition, unfortunately, it was in my blood. I'm convinced to this day that even my own mama considered the tomato a symbol of a person's God-fearing commitment to biblical and civic values. It may be hard to believe all that's wrapped up in one little red tomato, but that's the gospel truth. Martha Ann and I weren't falling for it, though. We didn't care what Mrs. Gladys Gulbink, our 80-year-old home economics teacher, tried to tell us. There were not enough ways to prepare a tomato to keep us entertained for a lifetime. Remember, Gulls, preached Mrs. Gulbink, always holding the most perfect red tomato in her hand for all of us to admire. You can fry them, bake them, stew them, and congeal them. A good wife and mother will always have a tomato on hand. I can still hear those words rumbling around my head some nights when I'm lying in bed and can't sleep. And the worst part, the really tragic part of it all, is that now, all grown up, I always have a couple of tomatoes sitting on the kitchen counter. That's just how strong a hold the tomato can have over a Southern girl. But when I was little, perched on that picnic table at the Dairy Queen, with Martha Ann sitting right by my side, I never once dreamed of tomatoes, not for a single solitary minute. No way. I spent my time thinking about being a Hollywood movie star or some famous doctor who cured hard-to-pronounce diseases. But one thing was for darn sure. After licking 1,000 dilly bars, we had successfully traced the roots of our discontent to one man, our great-granddaddy, William Floyd Klein. William Floyd is still considered a very important man in Ringgold, although he's been dead for a long, long time now. To this day, people talk about him as if they know him, kind of the same way they talk about somebody famous like Hank Aaron or Dolly Parton or Abraham Lincoln. The talk about him was always so big that sometimes Martha Ann and I wondered if he was still living, hidden up here somewhere on Taylor's Ridge. William Floyd was one of the most prolific bootleggers the state of Georgia has ever known. He brewed and ran illegal moonshine throughout northern Georgia and Alabama and southeastern Tennessee. His whiskey was corn-based, bitter, and wickedly potent. Everybody knew his was the best, and his customers paid top dollar for one of his little brown jugs. Mr. Tucker, down at the Dollar General store, said he heard that a man over in Bledsoe County slept for 3 whole weeks after drinking some of our great-granddaddy's moonshine. Standing no more than 5 feet 3 inches tall, William Floyd weighed about 170 pounds, but Daddy said it was all muscle. He said he had a barrel-shaped chest and arms as big and round as watermelons in July. He didn't have one single strand of hair on his head, and legend has it, his steely blue eyes could pierce through a man and see inside his soul. The shining business was a dangerous trade, and William Floyd found himself hunted, chased, and shot at, but fortunately never caught. Then one sticky Georgia afternoon in the middle of August, William Floyd made a spur-of-the-moment decision that changed his life and my family's fate forever. Smelling of corn mash and cigar smoke, he stumbled into a white tent propped up in the midst of some lonesome field next to some unmarked country road. And under that tent, with its canvas sides flapping in the gentle summer breeze, William Floyd found the Lord somewhere in the congregation's third singing of the fourth verse of Just As I Am. The preacher, who had found the Lord himself only the week before, took my great-granddaddy by the hand and led him down to the banks of the Tallapoosa River. And in the middle of that river, on that hot August day, with the cool water moving against their backs, the preacher lowered my great-granddaddy under the water, a sinner, and raised him up a man of God. Without much more than an amen, newly found brother William Floyd quit drinking, fighting, and cursing, and dedicated his life to his Savior Jesus Christ. My great-granddaddy didn't remember much of the days following his salvation. Story has it he walked miles and miles in some sort of divine day so high on the Lord that he glowed like the angel Gabriel. When he finally stumbled into Ringgold, the townspeople took one look at him and figured he'd been specially delivered by the Lord himself. They called him preacher, and within days he was sermonizing from his own makeshift pulpit next to a grove of cedar trees. And during the course of the next 40 years, he built a church and nurtured a flock, all the while delivering another type of libation just as intoxicating as his moonshine. So that's a little bit of Catherine Grace's history. And like I said, I didn't grow up in a small town, but I think like her, you know, I just always longed for something more, something bigger. And growing up in the 70s and early 80s, you know, women were just starting to believe that they maybe could do something bigger and something more. And in that way, I think Catherine Grace and I share quite a bit in common. So anyway, do you all have questions? This is always, I think, my favorite part, but don't feel, you know, pressured or obligated. There's usually that little awkward silence before someone asks the first one.
Gilmore then took questions from the audience. She was first asked how she had approached her research into Ringgold, Georgia, the setting of her novel.
I'd been there a lot. I did go back just to, you know, refresh because I was living in California, which I actually think being out of the South gave me some good perspective. Although I found with my second novel, I really needed to get back to the South because you forget a lot of things. But I did go back just to see the streets. And I know, in case anybody tells you, I know there is not a Dairy Queen in Ringgold, Georgia. There is a Chow Time, which has since closed. But looking for salvation at the Chow Time just didn't quite have the certain name. So.
Gilmore was asked about her former hometown of Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Well, from Nashville, it's, you know, about 2 hours. But Chattanooga, and we lived in Chattanooga. I have lived so many places. I was born in Nashville. As a young married woman with my first baby, we moved to Chattanooga. And were there when my parents were living in Ringgold. My father has since died, but at the time, so we were out in Ringgold a lot. But Chattanooga and Ringgold are just, you know, a stone's throw. You should see it now. It's just an incredible, and as I was telling everyone, you really must come to Chattanooga on, well, it won't be this year, but next year for the Conference on Southern Literature. It's just a wonderful opportunity to mix and mingle with Southern writers.
Who's your favorite Southern writer?
Well, I mean, Lee Smith, without a doubt. But, you know, I love Eudora Welty, and I love Jill McCorkle. And then there's some new, younger ones, Pamela Duncan. Actually, there's a group of women, 4 women, that studied under Lee at North Carolina State and formed a reading group, a writing group, Lynn York, Darnell Arnault, Pamela Duncan, and Virginia Boyd, who's actually going to be at the Virginia Festival of Books. They are all, you know, young and, you know, recently, well, not necessarily recently published, but they're all just beautiful Southern writers. And Pam Duncan's The Big Beautiful. It's just a lot of fun.
An audience member then asked about her current work in progress.
It's been a little bit harder for me. This story was one that I'd carried with me, you know, not for years, because obviously, as I said earlier, I didn't see myself as a novelist, but I had lived so much of this one. The second one is called Basilia Grove, and I'm working on that now. And it's about a Nashville girl, fifth generation, who's from a very affluent family, but just a wonderfully dysfunctional family. And I don't know what us writers would do without these wonderful dysfunctional families, because they're just the source of so much wonderful inspiration. But I was actually at a dinner party, to be quite honest, right after we moved to Nashville, and there was a woman there whose name was Z, and I said, wow, that's really interesting. She said, well, my name is actually Basilia. I said, wow, that is really something. She said, well, you think that's something? I'm fifth generation Basilia. And I just said, heck, that's incredible. For five generations, there'd be a Basilia. So this character, and that I named the book after Basilia Grove, is a fifth generation Basilia from Nashville. So we'll see. It's a little, I don't say darker, it's a little more complicated, a little more complex than this one. But these characters I miss terribly, and am very anxious. A lot of people have asked, are you going to continue the story? And I would absolutely love it. I would love to get back in their world. I was actually rather depressed when I finished. And it took me a few days to figure out why I was feeling so blue. And I realized I just missed them so much. I had never anticipated how real they would become. And in fact, I had heard writers say before that the character really, you know, led the way. And I thought, oh, that just sounds, I don't believe that. Sounds like a lot of chatter. But it was so true. They just become such a part of your life that they really do sometimes do things that you never anticipate that they need to do, not necessarily what you want them to do. And I have a great example, but if I tell you, then it's going to kind of blow part of it for you. So you're going to have to read it.
Gilmore discussed the use of dialogue in Looking for Salvation at the Dairy Queen.
There is some. That's an interesting observation. And, you know, dialogue is not my favorite part. But I'm regurgitating something when I'm writing a quote. I mean, you know, I'm just writing down what someone has already said. But to write dialogue, that's why, to be quite honest, I steered completely away from a screenplay, because it's all dialogue. And the descriptive part was just, you know, door slams, light comes through window. And it did not appeal to me at all. I honestly feel like that's one of my weakest areas, is dialogue. And I don't read it, you know, I don't dialogue with someone. I mean, a lot of screenplay writers work in teams, I think, for that very purpose. But I love the descriptive part. I'm really drawn to that.
Gilmore answered several questions about her work routine.
You know, I have a pretty strong work ethic. So I would go and sit down and work usually till noon. And if I was really on a roll, I'd work beyond that. I also had the great benefit, and I highly recommend this for anyone, you know, who is writing. Well, you all are in a group, so you have this advantage, but I have a reader who I trust implicitly. I trust her, you know, grammatically, spiritually, I mean, you name it. She is a wonderful friend and a wonderful advocate and a wonderful reader. So even when I was writing for the LA Times, I would always throw an article to her and let her look at it before I turned it in. And chapter by chapter, you know, it was kind of my treat at the end of the month. And I would have a goal. At the end of the month, I'll have a chapter done. And I would send it to her. And then we would meet, and this is really tough duty, in Laguna Beach, in this hotel restaurant on the beach, and watch the dolphins out the window and go over a chapter word for word. And then, and it is rare. I mean, I can probably count on one hand the time she has told me to change something that I disagreed and didn't. I just trust her that much. You know, and on the other hand, I think that's why journalism is such a great training ground for writers, because you work with a lot of editors, you have to be comfortable with being criticized, and you have to accept that there is benefit, you know, in being critiqued and edited. I don't have a problem when an editor tells me to change something. If I genuinely believe that it makes it better, I think, great. I mean, here's an opportunity for us to make this as good as it can possibly be. And I think some writers have a harder time with being criticized and edited, and it's just, you know, it's part of the game.
Do many writers have a reader that looks at every chapter after they finish?
You know, I know, like, I just heard Ann Patchett on NPR, and she has a reader as well, another writer, and I'm a reader for other writers. So I don't think it's uncommon. Do you know, David? Do you?
So this person was your friend first and then became your reader?
We actually worked, when I was in Chattanooga, I was working on a project to develop a bottling museum for Coca-Cola. Long story. Anyway, she was brought in from L.A., and then I ended up moving to L.A., and we just had always been friends, but we had come to know one another through work.
With your work schedule, the schedule that you set for yourself, let's say you stop at noon and the rest of the day you do something else, but aren't you distracted, or weren't you distracted by thinking, well, maybe she should have said this, or I should have put it this way, or did it happen to you? Were you
no, and you'd think it would, because I'm a very type A person, but no. When I was done, I was done. I mean, some days I would work till 3 if I was really driven, and if I was really on a roll, you'll see me working at night, which doesn't happen very often because I'm so not a night person. You know, I was never one of those that envisioned wearing a black turtleneck and smoking a cigarette and staying up till 3 in the morning writing. I mean, that just, you know, I would be more likely to be up at 5 in the morning and work. What I'm distracted by, though, is laundry, grocery shopping, email. The internet is just a terrible distraction for me now. And I was in a wonderful place in California where, you know, things were pretty settled and calm. And we've just moved about a year ago, and life has been much more unsettled. And my husband and I have each lost a parent, and I have not found that rhythm again. And I crave it, and I want it desperately. And I'm fortunate that I can write anywhere. So, I mean, I was writing here before you all came, you know, at a gas station, at a Dairy Queen, put me anywhere, I can write. But that rhythm is so important for me, because when you don't write every day, if you don't look at it or just touch it, even for 5 minutes, I think you start to lose touch with it, and it just takes you a little bit longer to get back into it, for me. You know, and every writer has their own method of madness, but for me. I mean, I don't have an outline. I heard a writer recently say he writes the ending first so he knows where he's going. I could no more do that because I don't know where it's going. So, anything else?
So you said you went to school here?
I did. I went to undergraduate here, majored in history, and then went to University of Texas in Austin for graduate school, and took a writing class. And I'll never forget my professor. The last day, I said, so, you know, what do I do now? I mean, being very type A, what do I go write? What do I go do? And he said, you need to live life. I was like, oh, okay. I wonder how my dad's going to feel about that, but okay. And, you know, and that's what I did. You know, I raised my kids and did the bake sales and the, you know, chaired the auctions and the Girl Scout troops and all of that. And then slowly but surely always freelanced or somehow kind of kept my finger in the pot somehow, but really was mom first and foremost. And, you know, the wonderful thing about 3 daughters, they remind you every day what it means to be coming of age. So I think that's why I'm drawn to these coming of age stories. And there's always, I've noticed, I was thinking about this the other day, a strong sister relationship. Not only do I have 3 girls, but I have 2 sisters. And that's just probably one of the most important relationships, you know, in my own life, that of sisterhood. Anything else?
Are you religious?
Yes.
Are you Baptist?
Raised Baptist, then Methodist, now Episcopalian, with a fascination with all things Buddhist.
With all things Buddhist?
Mm-hmm. I'm just very ecumenical. My mother-in-law was a Methodist minister, and she died in June. But, you know, faith has always been very important to me, and in one way or another, you know, I'm not a conservative person, I'm not a fundamental person, but the church community and going to church, you know, is a very important part of my life. And to be quite honest, there were so many parts of this book that it's hard to talk about this sometimes because I think people think, you know, that I am, you know, fundamentally driven, which I'm not at all, which is fine, but it's just not who I am, and I don't, you know, like to be identified that way. But there were so many times where this really felt like there was something divine going on, and I hesitate to talk about it because I'm always afraid it'll be misunderstood. But sometimes you'll write, you know, a few sentences, and you think, I don't even know where that came from. I mean, that was just so perfectly put down on paper that I didn't do that. And then there was just almost this wonderful calm that I had that this would be accepted, that it would be published, that I would. I mean, I had very few moments of just true doubt. There was always a calm about it, and I know that was not me because I'm not calm at all. In fact, I have to tell you, it's a little bit funny, but my husband and I were in San Francisco for a last little, you know, fling before we moved back to the South, and there was an agent who had led me to think maybe she was going to sign me, and then while we were in San Francisco, she sent me this email about how much she loved it and how this was great and that was great, but I have decided, you know, to go in another direction. I'm like, oh. So I start crying, and I cry the entire way down the coast to California, and we finally, around Hearst Castle, my husband said, do you mind if I just get out and look at the ocean, you know, one last time? And I was like, no, go ahead. I sat in the car and cried some more, got home, and my reader, Bonnie, she said, well, thank goodness she didn't sign you, because then she's not the right person for you. She didn't get it. She didn't understand it. And why would you want her to represent you? And so get off your little pity party and get back to work. And someday, Bonnie can be very annoying. Accurate, but annoying. And so the next day, I got that literary agent's guide book, and 5 days before we moved, I sent out 30, you know, just blind submissions. And it was out of that when I was in Laguna Beach for one last little trip with my daughter and had just taken her to the restaurant where I had done so much editing and working on this book. We came back, checked my email, and I had a letter of acceptance from an agent. So it just always felt like it was part of a greater plan. This one, the next one, I don't know. Not so much.
I hope you'll come back for the next one.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's supposed to come out next year, about this time. I'm getting a little panicked. Just a smidgen. That's why I was working up here before you all came, and I did talk to Lee recently, and she said, "Oh, honey, those deadlines really don't mean anything." But I'm very A-type, so I'm really trying to meet this deadline so we can come back and celebrate, and hopefully it will happen.
Finally, an audience member asked, what is a dilly bar?
You know, somebody, that was in one review, somebody criticized me for not describing the dilly bar, and I thought, oh my gosh, did I not? I thought I did. I did? Okay, good. It's like an Eskimo pie, but it's round and it's on a stick. And in, you know, my day, when they made them in-house, so they would have a curlicue like the Dairy Queen cone on the top. Now they're mass-produced, and they don't have the curlicue.
Well, I hope that you will sign copies of your book for those who would like to buy a copy.
Will do.
Also, if you'd like a chance to talk to the author a little bit more, will you do?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, David.